One man has said, Christ is to us what his cross is. You do not understand Christ till you understand the cross. And so it's no wonder that the great apostle Paul, who was an incredibly intelligent man, I'm not going to list out the various languages he knew and all the various topics that he would be able to discuss at a great length and this, that and everything else, but he was a mighty colossus of an intellect. He spoke to the church in Corinth, who were used to reading and hearing about various different ideas and were a pretty educated bunch and knowledgeable on various different levels. He said, I determined to know nothing while I was with you except for Jesus Christ and him crucified. As young believers, certainly the Bible is the first book that we would go to, and to read the various accounts in the Gospels is certainly absolutely necessary, and then to try to delve into some of the books of the New Testament, and some of them you may find very hard, like the book of Romans and Galatians maybe, and the book of Revelation. Other books are easier and simpler to use, but certainly as you begin to try and read things that help you to understand the Bible, and particularly the person and the work of Jesus, good books about the cross are absolutely vital and essential. If you've never read a really good book, a simple, easy book really, about the cross, and you would like to, then maybe come and see me afterwards and I can suggest various different books to read. Men that have spent many years, if not decades, reading the various accounts and reading the Apostle Paul and the other apostles, really trying to grasp and delve into what is happening, what is going on, what is the significance and the meaning of the cross. We're just spending a few weeks, aren't we, glossing over, if you like, looking into Mark's account and seeing what is it that Mark really wants his readers to understand. He is writing, isn't he, to Christians who are living in Rome, predominantly Jewish Christians that are living in Rome, and there were many other converts as well, but he's writing to them. They are being persecuted for the faith. Maybe a number of them, the Jewish ones particularly, are thinking, maybe we should leave Rome, maybe we should go back to Jerusalem, or go to Jerusalem if they were born outside of Jerusalem. And Mark, through Peter, the apostle, is writing to them and saying, well, the temple there, the veil being rent, there's no point in going back. You've got nothing to go back to. You've got to carry on serving. You've got to carry on living for the Lord. You've got to carry on suffering, as Jesus is the ultimate and perfect example of suffering, of carrying on, of trusting even in impossible circumstances. Well, we're going to see some of these things together this morning. Certainly, suffering is very much a part of Mark's gospel. Right from the very beginning, you have no birth narrative. There are no angels. There are no shepherds. There are no wise men. There is nothing that Mary has to say or sung or Zechariah or any of the others that are all recorded in the Gospel of Luke. But straight away, you're straight into, aren't you, the coming of Christ, the ministry of John the Baptist, and his imprisonment and death. And then all the way through the gospel, the cross is mentioned again and again and again. The shadow of the cross is cast over the whole gospel. The death of Jesus, one man wrote, broods over the entire account. A passion narrative with a long introduction is something that I've said on a few occasions. And so the going to the cross, making his way to the cross, prophecies of the cross are scattered from chapter to chapter through Mark's gospel. Well, here we find ourselves with Christ upon the cross and dying on it even this morning in Mark's account. I want to look just three things with you this morning. The first one is the suffering servant. Something that we've seen through the account of Mark, that Jesus really is the faithful servant of God. He says, and a lot of people say that it's really a centerpiece of Mark's gospel, where Jesus says that the Son of Man has not come to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. We've glossed over the sufferings. We've moved quite quickly, haven't we? But maybe just to read or remind ourselves of them this morning, we'll remind us that Jesus really is the suffering servant. Our first verse, verse 33 that we looked in this morning, reminds us of the darkness and then the cry from the cross. So the second thing we're going to look at this morning is Jesus, the rejected son. Although wonderfully the Roman soldier cries out, truly this was the Son of God. And all the way through the account, that's what Mark has been reminding and teaching us. Mark is all about who is Jesus. Jesus is the Son of God. But here we see him as the rejected son. We see the outcome of Jesus' death in the, well, not only the supernatural darkness that we see, but a supernatural sign from God as the veil is torn from top to bottom. And that points us to the fact that Jesus is a sufficient priest. Now, we might not understand that, and maybe a number of the Gentile believers in the church at Rome, as they were receiving this gospel, would have said as it was read to them, well, we understand a Roman centurion saying, truly, this is the Son of God. That's very, very helpful to us to see somebody who we would esteem highly, a centurion there who is at the cross watching, saying, truly, he is the Son of God. We find that very, very helpful. But what significance is that? A veil in the temple being torn from top to bottom? What does that mean? And maybe the Jewish believers in the church there at Rome would need to explain and help them understand like we do together this morning. So let's divide this up then briefly. The suffering servant, we have seen him suffering again and again and again, haven't we? As we go back to chapter 14 and verse 65, then some began to spit on him and to blindfold and to beat him and to say to him, prophesy, and the officers struck him with the palms of their hands. In chapter 15, it begins immediately in the morning. The chief priests held a consultation with the elders. So he's gone through beatings and spittings, hasn't he, through the night? And he is now exhausted. And now early in the morning, without any sleep, he has taken, isn't he, to Pilate. In verse 15, we're reminded, so Pilate, wanting to gratify the crowd, released Barabbas to them. And he delivered Jesus after he had him scourged. Now we can read it and the words roll off of our tongue, but it was so barbaric that many men died from a scourging before they even got to the cross. There is by no means any guarantee that many men will survive a scourging to be crucified. Many men, stout men, healthy men, strong men would have died in the ordeal, particularly if you had an inexperienced soldier who is getting some experience maybe in learning how to scourge somebody. They had got it down to a fine art so that they would take you to the very brink of death itself, but not allow you to die and have you hanging there between life and death for as long as they could. Mark's gospel is written to the Romans. And the Romans are basically saying, through doing this, scourging Christ and others and crucifying them, saying, how dare you rebel against Rome? How dare you declare yourself to be a king? How dare you in any way, shape or form try to advocate the non-paying of taxes? We demand absolute, total submission to Caesar. We want you to acknowledge Caesar as a son of God and divine. And if you do not pledge absolute, total allegiance, not just of money and of your body, but of your mind, your heart and your will to Caesar, this is what we will do to you. We see in verse 17, don't we? And they clothed him with purple and they twisted a crown of thorns and they put it on his head, and that certainly would have been excruciating. So he has been spat upon, he has been slapped and beaten, he has been scourged and whipped, and we know that it was a leather whip with bits of bone or glass embedded into it that would lacerate the back and literally rip off the flesh from the back, so that often the ribs and even some of the internal organs could be clearly seen. The purple robe, that would have aggravated it, wouldn't it? And certainly the crown of thorns upon his head. In verse 19, then they struck him again on the head with a reed and they spat on him again, bowing the knee. They were mocking him. In verse 21, then they compelled a certain man, Simon of Cyrenian, the father of Alexander and Rufus, as he was coming out of the country and passing by, to bear his cross. Why? Because he's absolutely physically exhausted. He would have been emotionally tormented. He would have been mentally tormented. He would have been physically beyond exhaustion, and in total exhaustion collapses. And if they'd have forced him to carry on taking the part of the cross, he more than likely would not have made it alive, humanly, physically speaking. And in verse 24, and it just rolls off, doesn't it? And when they crucified him, they divided his garments. Now, you can read other accounts in John or in Luke or in Matthew, and you can make more and you can find out more of the details of Christ's sufferings. And they are there to help us to grasp and to really understand what he had to go through and endure. Well, Mark is writing to the Romans. They know about crucifixion. The details don't need to be laid out for them, because they know very well what happens when you are condemned as guilty, deserving of capital punishment and death. And so although Mark's gospel is all about the suffering servant, all the intricate details of what went on in the suffering don't need to be there, because Mark's readers know very well the details of what happens when a man is condemned, guilty, scourged, and crucified by Rome. What Mark wants us to see is not so much the physical, emotional, mental torment of it all, but the significance of it. You see, we only have one cry from the cross. If you want to get all of the details, Mark's gospel is not that helpful. All of these things are in the other gospels and a whole lot besides. What Mark really wants, the writer really wants the readers to grasp, is the spiritual significance of what is happening at the cross. They would have known, the Jewish believers, and I'm sure that they would have helped the Gentile believers in saying, here is our suffering servant. Here is the one who has come to serve us. God spoke very clearly about him in the book of Isaiah, particularly in chapters 52 and 53. He talks about my servant, and then he talks about him as my righteous servant. By and through his knowledge will justify many. There were other songs in Isaiah that speak, don't they, about the Messiah coming to be the servant of God and the servant of his people. And that's what Mark wants us to understand. He remains silent, doesn't he, before Pilate? There's very little speech, really, between the garden of Gethsemane and this cry from the cross that is recorded here. Mark wants us to see that he goes silently and humbly to the cross to serve us. The servant giving himself in redemptive sufferings to ransom and to redeem us. The one who goes as a substitute, voluntarily giving his life in the place of others. The kingdom of God and the whole concept of Christ's kingship and kingdom and everything else is very, very key to Mark's gospel. He's writing to people who understand about an empire, understand about kingdoms, understand about emperors and Caesars, and they understand about authority and structure and everything else. They understand about being citizens and serving the greater common cause of Rome. And Mark is writing to saying, as you understand these things, they didn't live in the modern world where we understand a lot more and the general education of the people is a lot higher. They were simple folk. And they write to them and says, you understand this concept, don't you? You understand this concept of authority and hierarchy, and you may have people under you who are there to serve you and people who are above you whom you serve. Well, in one sense, Jesus is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords and is to be served. But in another sense, because of our sinfulness, because of our fallenness, because of our separation from God, you need one who will come to serve you.
So in one sense, Jesus is way up the ladder, higher than the emperor, higher than any other name. But in another sense, whoever you are on the social ladder within Rome, Jesus has humbled himself, lowered himself, and come and served you at the cross. We see Jesus serving various different people through the Gospels, don't we? Coming to the blind, coming to the bereaved, coming to the lame, coming to the poor, coming to the leper, coming to the needy. We see, don't we, in John's account, coming and washing the disciples' feet. We see Jesus serving again and again through the Gospels. But this is the ultimate act. The final act, the most important act that we all need to grasp and understand. And the writer of Mark wants us to understand that he is suffering to serve you. That you deserve this. Not just temporarily within time, so that somehow, like sort of purgatory or something, you can get to heaven. No, but you deserve this eternally. You deserve to suffer. You deserve to come under the judgment of God for all of eternity. Because you have rebelled. Now, Rome saw Jesus and others as rebels against Rome, so they judged them, condemned them, and executed them. But surely, we've rebelled against a far higher authority and deserve an unimaginably dark and dismal punishment and consequences for our sin. These are things that Mark's readers would have understood. Luke writes to the Gentiles, to the Greeks, doesn't he? And he writes, and they understand about philosophy. They understand about lots of other things, don't they? And so he writes about lots of other things and doesn't need to explain them. The gospel writers are very conscious and very aware of who they are writing to and what they understand. The Romans didn't want people vastly educated in philosophy and poetry and this, that, and the other. They just wanted people to understand authority, to submit to it, and to serve those who are above you. And if you do that, the empire will be great. That's their concept, their thinking, their mindset. So their heroes were soldiers, their heroes were generals and warriors, their heroes weren't great thinkers and philosophers or politicians, but soldiers. Men who submitted to the authority ultimately of Caesar and would go into battle, no matter what the cost, at the whim of a superior soldier or superior authority. Well, Mark wants us to understand, yes, he is superior to us. He's been telling us again and again that he is the King of Israel and he's the King of the kingdom and he's the one that comes to set up the kingdom of God and everything else. But you must also understand that he humbly, very humbly, even silently, came to serve us. And that's why, although Mark would have been very aware of the various other things that Jesus would have said and the other things that could have been said, he just simply records Jesus crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And nothing else. The one who willingly, uncomplainingly accepts and voluntarily serves us almost silently to secure our salvation. Giving us an example, as Peter puts it, in suffering. Well, that's certainly what Mark definitely wants us to see, and we can't miss that. We should have seen that already in various different ways through the gospel and certainly at the cross. But the second thing, and a big thing for us here this morning, is to see that he is the rejected son. It's Christmas, isn't it, nearly? And what happens at Christmas? Well, what happens? We have at night time, there is suddenly angels and light and music. Now, it's the middle of the day, and it's the exact opposite. At the beginning of the gospel recorded in Luke, it's night time, but there's brightness and there's angels and there's music and there's singing. But now it's the middle of the day and there's darkness and silence. You can't but see the contrast as you read all four Gospels, maybe. But here we see the awful gloom. It begins in the darkness, doesn't it? Where Jesus is sorrowful unto death. He is sweating great drops of blood, we are told in Mark's account. And it goes through, doesn't it? Through, and it's getting worse and worse and worse. And he's been betrayed by Judas. He's been denied, hasn't he, by Peter. And the others have all forsaken him. And the scourging and the crown of thorns and the various other things go on. But as we get to the cross itself, Mark wants us to see that Jesus is the real Passover lamb. That if you like, the Gentile believers in Rome might not have understood it, but the Jewish ones would have needed to help them out with some of these details. It was Passover. Means it was a full moon. Therefore, this darkness could not be an eclipse. This darkness was supernatural. This darkness was God himself testifying supernaturally to what is happening at the cross is the most significant thing in all of the history of the world. Understand him as your suffering servant, but understand him as the rejected son of God as well. The last plague in Egypt was darkness, wasn't it, before the plague of death came upon them. What is happening here is one is taking our judgment in our place. He is the one who, Paul says very clearly, is the one who redeems us from the curse of the law because he was accursed. For it says, cursed is everybody who hangs upon a tree. Maybe some of the younger believers, the new believers, the Gentile pagans who had been converted to Christ or were maybe listening to this gospel being read and really thinking about becoming Christians or not, didn't understand these details and it needed to be filled in. But certainly for the Jewish believers and certainly for us as we look back in our modern day and age, we can see these things. This is a supernatural darkness. This is the condemnation of God coming down upon the rejected son. The plague of darkness in Egypt now is replaced by the darkness at the cross. And the plague of death that would come down upon the firstborn if there was not blood sprinkled upon the doorposts is coming down upon Jesus. And the firstborn is not going to be protected, but the firstborn, Christ himself, is going to become the very Passover lamb itself. Now, these words are from Psalm 22, and you can gather from various other accounts of the cross and everything else that Jesus is going through the Psalms. He starts earlier on in the Psalms and he quotes various different Psalms, 22 and on to chapter 34 for us in the chapters and everything else. He's very much thinking, meditating upon these various Psalms and quoting from them. But Mark doesn't give us all of those details. What does Mark want us to see? Mark wants us to see that in a sense, Jesus is not going from the beginning of Psalm 22 where there is the cry, my God, why have you forsaken me? And through the Psalm to victory and to conquest, but in actual fact, seemingly is going backwards in his experience. In Psalm 22, you have later on the gambling for clothes, but that happens earlier on, doesn't it? In Psalm 22, in verses 6 and 8, you have the Messiah being mocked. Well, that happens later on in the Psalm, but earlier on in Mark. And so it's as if Psalm 22, we are going backwards from conquest and victory and hope and assurance to being utterly and absolutely forsaken. To be rejected. And this is what is happening in the experience of Christ. Christ knows how the psalm ends, but his experience is telling him something completely different. The lifelong bond of dynamic love that united Christ as a man to God the Father is now not just disappearing, that has disappeared. He's plunged into the horror of utter destruction as the Christ. And at that moment, as he, the apostles help us and explain to us, as he becomes sin, yes, he is the suffering servant who comes to serve us, and the thing that we really need above everything else is not for somebody to come and show us where all the gold is on the earth. It's not for somebody to come and collect for us all the greatest philosophers and mix-match them together to give us some perfect philosophical understanding of the meaning of life or anything else. The thing that we really need is for the Son of God to serve us and to be utterly rejected in our place. That's what we deserve. You see, in this life, there's such confusion, isn't there, about who is God and what is God like and what is the meaning of life and absolutely everything else. It's because, in a sense, God has cursed us and somewhat turned away from us, rightly, because of our sin. But now, here is the one whom God has not turned away from initially. Here is the one who, well, we know in Mark's account, there is the audible voice from heaven that says, "This is my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased." But now heaven is as brass and silent, and God has turned away. And the rejected Son cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Mark talks about this cup that he has to drink, this cup of wrath, and what is happening is he doesn't just forsake him, he doesn't just turn away from him. In one sense, as his Father, he turns away, and the other accounts say that Jesus continues to address Jesus as Father at the beginning, even on the cross, and he finishes off with, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." But at this point, when the darkness reaches its darkest depth, as Jesus is now drinking the last dregs, if you like, of the cup of God's wrath, the Father has turned away, but God the Judge has very much turned towards him and is judging and punishing him. As if what the disciples did in betraying him and forsaking him and running away and publicly denying him wasn't enough. As if the mental and the emotional torture of what the Roman soldiers and the priests had already done to him wasn't enough. As if the physical sufferings of what Rome had done to him on the cross wasn't enough. It is now God the Father who turns away and comes and punishes him to satisfy his own justice. Romans understood the concept of justice. We understand justice, don't we? We have a police system. You are rewarded or punished at school or at home for your behavior. We are rewarded or punished in various different ways, aren't we, by the authorities above us. We have the police. We have the judicial system. We have prison. We no longer have the execution or capital punishment, but we used to. And many places around the world still have it. We understand this concept of justice. Well, here is the one who is just. Here is the one who is righteous. Here is the one who is sinless even. And Pilate has a real sense of it. And the centurion does. When he sees the way in which Jesus dies, the centurion, who had a very clear understanding of justice and judgment, he looks up and says, "That's not a guilty criminal deserving of death." He would have seen hundreds of guilty criminals die. And they don't cry out in a loud voice and then die. They slowly ebb away. In excruciating pain, trying to lift themselves up upon the cross so that they can take another breath of vital air. And slowly but surely they mumble and grumble until there's silence, and then they slowly fade away. Not so in Jesus' case. He cries out in a loud voice and then breathes his last. And the centurion can see that this man is different. He doesn't say, "This is a guilty criminal deserving of death, but he has died in a very strange way. I've never seen anything like that. I've never seen a guilty criminal die like that." He looks up and he sees. And although Mark doesn't record all of the other things that the other writers record, that centurion saw and heard everything that was recorded in the Gospels and probably some more. Truly, this man was the Son of God. He's not guilty. He's not deserving of this. He's the righteous, innocent sufferer, the rejected son in the place of his people. He may have been anxious, this soldier. He may have been in charge of the other soldiers there, and the darkness coming over may have made him very, very anxious. Will there be a rescue? Could well be. Public figure. Lots of disciples. He doesn't know that one of his disciples has betrayed him and the other one has denied him, cursing under oath 3 times, and all of the others have run away and fled. He doesn't know these things. They were walking on eggshells at a time like this at Passover, where there would have literally been tens or hundreds of thousands of Jews coming in from all over the land, as well as the usual occupants of Rome itself. Will there be a rescue plan? Will a group come in the darkness and in the cover of darkness? Is this some kind of a prophet, some kind of a miracle worker who has brought upon this supernatural, miraculous darkness so that his disciples can come to rescue him? Not at all. Nobody comes to rescue him. Not even God the Father comes to rescue him. Not only does God the Father turn away, but God the Judge comes and pours upon him what you and I, everybody who will end up in heaven, deserve. He's the rejected son. Now we can add all of the details from the other Gospels and everything else, but Mark doesn't really want us to do that. There are some things that Mark leaves for the other gospel writers, and there are some things that Mark really wants us to see. God really wants you to see this morning that Jesus is the suffering servant and the rejected Son of God. Third and final thing that Mark and the Lord would really want us to see from this is that he is a sufficient priest. We've already said that maybe to the Gentile believers who were new believers, or certainly to pagan Romans who were coming in to the gathering of the church and would have been fearfully thinking and wondering whether he really is the Son of God or not, they may not have understood verse 38, then the veil of the temple was torn from top to bottom. And some of them maybe, what does that mean? I don't know. Well, we know, we studied the whole book of Hebrews just recently as a church. We know what these things mean. That he is a sufficient priest. That veil was in the temple. It's a particularly Jewish thing. It's not a worldwide concept, or particularly a concept like justice or judgment or ransoming and redeeming or serving and suffering that Roman citizens would have been very, very familiar with. This is a Jewish concept, isn't it? That the high priest, as one of the little ones told us this morning, would go, and we can add some details, he would go, wouldn't he, with blood, and he would go once a year with a branch of hyssop, with fear and trembling, taking off all of his royal regal robes as the high priest, humbling himself, just going in that linen ephod that he would wear, and he would go with fear and trembling behind the veil to sprinkle on the mercy seat, wouldn't he? To propitiate God's wrath, so that as God looks down, what does he see? He sees broken law. He sees sin. He sees rebellion. But the priest would go and sprinkle blood on the mercy seat. And if the high priest lived to tell the tale and came out living, it meant that God had accepted the Passover lamb that year, and their sin was covered until the next year at least. Well, Jesus goes not just to temporarily cover sin until there is another greater, better, or future sacrifice, but he goes once and for all, doesn't he? And so as God is saying, this darkness is portraying to you, it's helping you to try to grasp and understand the depths that God is willing to go to serve and save you. Darkness reveals something, doesn't it, of the rejected son, but
The torn veil reminds us, doesn't it, that he is a sufficient priest. Now, within the Catholic system and within many other systems of religion, you need a priest. You need men who just keep dying. They keep offering masses. They keep offering sacrifices, don't they? They keep offering prayers on your behalf, and you keep having to go to these sacrifices and these priests and these offerings and these various different things. Well, God would tell us these things are useless, and that there is once for all a final sacrifice, and that what Jesus has done is totally, completely sufficient to get you right with God for time and for all of eternity. It's the work of a priest, isn't it? The work of a priest is to go on behalf of guilty worshippers and offer something to God so that he will forgive and cleanse and wash and receive and accept and help and bless them. Well, Jesus accomplishes absolutely everything. So everything that you could possibly ever need from God and so much more is available to us in Christ. He accomplishes, he achieves, doesn't he? He affects redemption. That's what much of the book of Mark is about. We need to be redeemed. We're in the slave market of sin and death. Concepts very, very close and understandable to the Roman mindset. That we too are enslaved to sin. We too are enslaved to death. We too are enslaved to eternal condemnation. But this sufficient priest, through serving us and being rejected, judged and punished in our place, becomes a sufficient priest, and everything that God has and can do to help us is surely on offer in Christ. The penalty, the power, the pollution, the pleasure, and even the presence of sin is done with. The curse that sin deserves and has been put upon us is been done with. Mark is crying out to us, isn't he? Here's your Redeemer. Not from the persecutions of Rome, may it be, but from a far greater, more serious, powerful evil. The irony of it is he saved others. Himself he cannot save, they say. The truth of it is, he saves others in not saving himself. Could have easily saved himself. We see his power, don't we, over darkness. We see his power over evil spirits. We see his power to call down angels. We see his power over leprosy, power over death, power over disease, power over this, that, and everything else. The end of Mark's gospel reminds us that he has not only the power to resurrect people temporarily from death, but the power to overcome death and triumph over it ultimately and absolutely. He doesn't save himself so that he can save his people. The purpose of Mark's gospel is to keep Christians from apostasy and from turning from the shame of the cross. If you were living in the times that Mark was writing and you were living in Rome, you were living in the first century there, and you said to your neighbour, your paganism's a bit useless, like we turn around, don't we, to the people in our modern day, your modern philosophy and your pop psychology and this, that and everything else that you're trusting in, it can't help you. Come to the church. Come and hear about the living God. Come and hear about the one who has a name above every other name. Come and hear about the final authority in heaven and on earth. Oh, and by the way, he was crucified. Not very attractive or appealing to the Roman mindset. But in actual fact, it's the most attractive thing. He does save others in not saving himself. He does prove himself to be the highest final authority in willing to suffer to serve us. In being the rejected Son of God and that sufficient priest, so that when he had breathed his last, yes, the Roman soldier cries out something, but God cries out something all that more important. It's done. It's finished. It's over. It's accomplished. It's achieved. Everything that you need from a priest is found
in him. The conclusion is that the Jesus of Mark is an overwhelming king of the universe. He is a complete revelation of God to us as a prophet. That he is a sufficient priest who does all to reconcile us, keep us in a right standing with God, and secure God's favor upon us, not only in this life, but in the life to come. His sovereign power reaches its summit, not by avoiding the cross, by accepting and embracing it. So as we close, for some of us this morning, my prayer is that you will make these words, the centurion, your own. That you will walk away. Truly, this Jesus is the Son of God. There's all the evidence in the world that testifies to us. There's no reason in the world to reject him. There's no scientific evidence, archaeological evidence, philosophical evidence, or any other evidence at all that could stop us. Here is a man who understands justice. Here is a man who understands judgment. Here is a man who understands authority. Here is a man who understands suffering. Here is a man who understands execution. Here is a man who would have naturally called Caesar the Son of God and the highest authority. But he sees the evidence of a man who voluntarily dies, a man who has power over death, a man who just doesn't expire in utter exhaustion and suffocation, but a man with power and authority gives his life to death, voluntarily chose to die. And we know in the place of others. And his response, truly this man was the Son of God. The suffering servant who endures the punishment his people deserve. The rejected son who enters the darkness so that we might have life and light through him. A sufficient priest who can really help us. Who's able to share with us pain of desertion, the lowliness of suffering, the darkness of depression, the bewilderment of circumstances, the agony of death. How? Because he has been there and in impossible circumstances, even as he's drinking the cup of wrath, says, my God. He can't say my Father, but in trust, he can say my God. The exemplary disciple who encourages us to go on carrying our cross until we see him face to face. The conquering king who defeats the oppressive powers that threaten our fallen world. And once the whole symphony of Mark is heard with all of its minor and major notes, the Jesus of Mark is overpowering. As one man has said, let the weak find him in him their champion, and the strong their conqueror. That's who he is. What will you do? Will you turn away again? Reject these things? What are you turning back to? What are you rejecting him for? What have you got better than he could ever give? Mark wants us to see, amongst many, many other things, Jesus really is the suffering servant, the rejected son, a sufficient priest, and you must live upon him and him alone. Amen.